Okay, it gives me a great pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Joanna Semper Fi.
Hi, my name's Joanna and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joanna.
Okay, serenity now, right? First, I want to thank Billy for asking me to lead, and I want to thank those who went to Panera Bread with me. I was having a really rough day. I've been up since 5 this morning and moving my store around, and it was just one thing after another, and Chris called me, and she said, don't worry, when you get to Panera and you get a little fellowship in you, everything will be fine, and she absolutely was right. It was amazing, so thank you guys. So let me get the statistics out of the way. I have a sobriety date of May 17th, 2013. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have sponsees, and I hold commitments. I'm a secretary of a meeting, and let's just get to it, right? So I was born to an Italian father and an Irish mother, and my father committed suicide when I was 6 months old on Christmas Eve, and my mom remarried when I was 18 months old to a Chilean man. So I was really close to my biological dad's family, you know, the Italian family. So my first drink that I can remember was when I was like this high. I had my own wine glass. You know, I had my own setting at the table. We would do peaches and vino, two for him, three for me, one for him, five for me. Like, that's just how it went down. And, when I was 12, my brother was hit by a car and killed, and then I was sexually assaulted, and my life kind of rolled down. And I don't say that because that's what makes me an alcoholic, because it absolutely does not. But for me, in looking back, that's when the hole inside that you hear about started for me. And that's when I felt that my God at the time totally had let me go, and that I needed to start running the show, and that I needed to be the God in my life. And that's exactly what happened. I didn't drink until I was later in my teens, but, you know, at 12 years old, I definitely had the alcoholic behaviors, you know. I loved money, and you know, I never felt like I wasn't, like I didn't fit in, but I always had to be the center of attention, and I always had to be, like, the go-to girl, you know. So when I was 12, right after all this stuff went down, some trucking company checks were sent to my house. And I wrote them to the surf club at my private school that I went to that I was later expelled from, to all these different things. And when my mom asked me, when the stuff started showing up at my house, like DVD players and, you know, all this stuff, it was like natural for me to tell her that I won them in a raffle, you know. So it was weird, you know. And so anyways, I was down in San Diego, and we ended up moving up here. And so we moved up to Santa Maria, or to Orchid, because my dad had family here. And you know, when I went to Orchid Junior High, and I was the new girl, I was the new blonde from, you know, San Diego, and I had to prove myself. So I was in fights constantly. And that was like my next kind of, you know, alcoholic behavior. It was like always to the excess. I would ride buses that I didn't even take so that I could beat up girls when they got off the bus, just because, you know. And then I started smoking cigarettes, and it just crazy. I was just doing crazy things. I was always looking for something that would make that, you know, that feeling, you know. And I remember my first party that I ever went to. I was probably 15 at the time, because it was right before I moved out. I was 15 at the time, and it was a house party when they used to have house parties here in Santa Maria. And I walked in there, and this girl had this bottle of Jose Cuervo. And I just remember taking that bottle from her and just tipping it back. Just jump, 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 and just being like, oh, wow, you know, there it is. Didn't feel like that later on that night, but I did it then, and I knew that I had arrived, and that's what it was about, you know. And then my aunt started drinking with me, and you know, drugs are a part of my story. They absolutely are. I didn't identify as an alcoholic at all until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always thought, you know, it was real easy for me to identify as a drug addict because that, I didn't think that alcohol was a problem ever. You know, so long story short, you know, I was in high school and I transferred from St. Joe's. I was this, you know, all-American athlete, number one 100-meter runner in Santa Barbara County. I was like, you know, varsity in all three sports my freshman year, straight-A student, and I decide that I'm going to chase a boy across the street to Rigetti. And I leave my sophomore year and I go to Rigetti, and it was on, you know, the drinking and the drugging and not going to school and only showing up on test days and when certain assignments need to be turned in, you know. And they called my parents in the office, and they said, you know, your daughter has a 3.8 GPA, but we're going to have to drop her with us because she's not attending class. So what we're going to do is we're going to take her out, and we're going to send her to Hancock, and we're going to let her go on independent study. Well, that's like the brightest thing, right? You take a teenager and you throw her with a bunch of college kids. That's like disastrous, right? So, you know, my partying totally progressed, and I thought I was doing something, you know, and I graduated from Rigetti High School a year early at 17, and I decided that I needed to do something with my life, and I joined the Marine Corps. So I joined the Marine Corps at 17. I turned 18 in boot camp, and it was amazing, you guys. I loved being a Marine, and I was good at it, and, you know, but it was weird because I joined the Marine Corps to travel, and they ended up stationing me at Camp Pendleton, exactly where we moved from, you know. And when I joined back then, you could drink at 18 on base, beer. You couldn't drink hard liquor, but you could drink beer on base. And so that's what I did, you know. And all my boys had were all like, all my boys that were in my motor pool had all had just gone back from overseas from Okinawa. So my mission, because I could outrun them, and I could outshoot them, and I could out-PT them, but I couldn't outdrink these guys. So that was like my mission. I'm going to outdrink them. And I tried, and I ended up on the floor many a times. And there are times that we got so trashed that we would get hooked up to IVs from the corpsman that lived in the barracks and before PT run. And you know, we were doing whippets. I mean, we just would get obliterated, and that was my life. It was like I was a Marine from 9:30 to 5:30, but, you know, towards the end, I was a Marine from 9:30 to 5:30, but I was a drunk at night, you know, and that's just the way it was. And I didn't think that it was affecting my military career at all because I moved up the ranks very quickly. I was a sergeant before I was 21. I had just received the NAM, which is the Navy Achievement Medal, which is very, very hard to earn when you're in the Marine Corps. And 90 days before my EAS, I had gone on leave and went on a nice drinking binger and did some other substances and came back and found out that one of my own Marines had committed suicide. And they found a bottle of booze and they found a joint next to him. So it was time for a battalion-wide sweep. And, you know, before this, I always gave the UAs, so it didn't really matter. And mind you, let me just back up and say that I drove trucks. I drove hazardous materials and explosives, and I remember times where I was probably still drunk. This one particular time, I know I was still drunk, and I had to take some blasting caps out to a range for some troops, and this gunny comes screaming. And I'm like, what is he yelling at? You know, and I probably raked. Well, I got out of my truck and the blasting caps were like sitting on the edge of my trailer. You know, I could have like blown up my truck, you know, and anyways, so so I take your analysis and of course, I'm dirty, you know, and I look at it like, whatever, I have 90 days left in the Marine Corps, you know, like, I'm a decorated Marine. Don't you know who I am? And I just found out that I was pregnant. So now I'm having my first kid. You know, what's up with this? Well, yeah, they ended up doing a big, huge investigation and a bunch of stuff. And I'll just say that when I didn't think drinking and drugs were interfering with my military career, they very much were because it landed me 10 years in the brig. I was sentenced to 10 years confinement. And I was busted down to an E1, and I had to give birth to my first son in jail, you know, and I didn't get him back until he was three. And at that point, I decided that I was going to do something with my life while I was incarcerated, and I did get, you know, a college degree, and I did think that I was doing well, and I got out, and, you know, I had a kid. I had an instant three-year-old, and then, you know, I have a problem with alcohol, money, and men, and hims, and hers, and, you know, and so I got a him, and the him turned into another kid, and then it turned into another kid, and I did what I knew how to do, and that was to go back to what I knew, you know, and before I knew it, I had three kids, and I was back hitting the bottle very heavily, and I was back using other substances, and you know, that turned into a few more prison terms, and now I've done federal time, and now I'm doing state terms, you know, and I did a few state terms, and when I was 30, I got clean, okay, and I didn't think I was an alcoholic, you know, and I look at it now, and I was like, I was drinking every day. I was getting up at 2 in the morning and pulling the cold vodka out of the refrigerator because I needed to, you know. But I didn't identify or think that alcohol was a problem for me. And so a few years later, I was diagnosed with cancer, and then I was diagnosed with cancer again, and that was my excuse, you know, really, it was. That was my excuse to hit it and hit it hard, and that's exactly what I did. And I was sharing with a few people before that it's weird because I totally thought like only 6 months had gone by and a few years had gone by, you know. One of my last bottoms, because I don't believe that I've ever really hit my bottom. My story is I'll get to a bottom and then I pull over and I grab the shovel and I start digging a ditch, you know. And then when I think I've hit the bottom of the ditch, I dig a little bit deeper. You know, that's just the way that my life is. You know, it's like you see this wall and I've got to keep running into it until it's like bloody and mashed, and it's like I still don't get it. Like there's another way, right? So the last like really bad was I was in a blackout, you know, I downed some vodka. And I took a bunch of pills, and I guess I tried fighting with my husband, and at the time, he was 7. I took my 7-year-old son, and I locked him in a room with me. And I told my parents and everybody on the other side of the door, just let him hold me while I die. And I don't know what that did to my son, and I probably will never know what that did to my son. But I remember that, and I remember leaving the house, and the next thing I remember, I hear them saying 5150, how it all stats, and waking up in Vista Del Mar Hospital, thinking that one day had gone by when really 3 had passed. And the alcoholic that I am, I decided that I was going to check myself out against doctor's orders because I know what's best for me. You don't. And I left the hospital, and I was out on bail, and I decided that I was going to commit more crimes, and so I did. And you know, it went downhill real fast, and you know, I looked at myself like I was doing good because I wasn't around my kids. You know, I never identified with being homeless, but, you know, my sponsor always told me, did you ever have a key to your house? No, then you were homeless. You know, I was living in my parents' garage. I was breaking into my own home to try to get stuff so that I could buy what I needed to buy, you know, and it all caught up to me. I showed up for a court date and I was arrested, and I still was like, do you know what you're doing, you know, and I was cut off. I found out later that my parents had turned me in, and I was pissed and I was angry and I hated them, you know, because it's not me, it's all you guys, it's your fault, it's not my fault, you did this to me, you know, and that's how I felt. And I'd like to say that it stopped when I was incarcerated, but it sure didn't, because I'm smooth and I'm like Cool Joe, and you can't keep the drugs and the alcohol away from me. I'll just drink hand sanitizer and you know, get drugs sent into me, and that's what I did, you know, and until it caught up with me. I went through every, was it the farm? I went through every. I just was in fights, and I was just running amok all over the jail. They didn't know what to do with me, you know, but throw me in ISO at the very end. And at that point, you guys, I had started to experience that pitiful and comprehensible demoralization that they talk about. You know, and I was laying in that cell, and I had just been sentenced to 12 years, and I really believed to my core that this is what my life was going to be, that this is all it was going to be. I was going to read books and die in a jail cell, you know. And that, sadly enough, was okay with me, you know, because I knew. I knew when I was going to get fed, you know, I knew when I was going to bathe. I knew, it was just weird that that was okay with me, that I was totally content within myself. And I don't know what came over with me, and I don't know if it's that, but, you know, there's a man in the jail that works there, his name's Chuck McLean, and he watched me come in and out of that jail for 10 years. And that man walked by my cell one day, and he said, you know, I really want you to fill out this application, and I looked at him like he was crazy. But I had that little window opened, like, that much. And I said, well, what do I have to lose, you know? And I filled out this application for Casa Serena. Mind you, I'm sitting on a 5-year sentence inside the jail, okay? And I filled out the application, you guys, and a week later, maybe it was a few days later, I was interviewed by Nancy over the phone, and a week after that, they were putting an ankle monitor on my leg, and I was being released to Casa Serena, and I was like, oh my gosh, on a scholarship, couldn't believe it, you know? And it was so weird, and I, you know, at first, I was like, yes, I got out of jail, this is my ticket, just do what you gotta do, fake it till you make it, fake it till you make it, you know? And, man, they could see right through that shit, you guys. I lied about my sobriety date for the first probably month and a half that I was there because I wanted them to believe that the 9 months that I was in jail was sober time for me because I wanted to be the one in the house that had the most sobriety time. I wasn't going to be a newcomer, you know. And I went to a meeting. They took us to meetings, and I went to a meeting, and I heard my story. This big black guy from L.A. came in and spoke. And the way of life, and I heard my story like all the way down to the military stuff, and I was just like, nah, you know, that's a fluke. And we went to another meeting, and I heard my story again, and my ears kind of perked up, and I was like, maybe I should start paying attention to what's going on in these rooms, you know? And it was on a Wednesday night, I got this weird sick feeling in my stomach, because, you know, I had worked already step 1 through 3 with my sponsor, and I was doing what I was supposed to be doing in the house so that it looks good on paper, you know? And, but I got this weird feeling in my stomach, and something came over me, and I decided to change my sobriety date because of what I did in jail, you know? And they laughed at me, and they said, did it affect you from the neck up, or did you try to, you know, have it affect you from the neck up? Well, yeah, okay, then you need to change your sobriety date. And it was like no big deal to them. I was so bizarre. I thought, oh my God, these people are going to judge me. Nobody judged me. Nobody cared. As a matter of fact, they opened their arms and they just loved on me because they saw the pain that I was in. And it was the first time that I really trusted, you know? And from there, it just like, I broke open. So that was me taking fully the first step, me fully admitting to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, and it was time for me to get rigorously honest, you know, because I was such a liar and a cheat and a manipulator, you know, and it was such everybody's fault and wasn't mine. I mean, I would put myself, we put ourselves in positions where we're later be hurt, you know, and it's crazy, you know. I did a stupid reality TV show, and I had to fourth step it, you know what I mean? I was so pissed off on how they portrayed me on TV, but you were a drunk going on a reality TV show. How the hell do you think they're going to portray you, you know? And so that was me taking the first step. And the second step, you know, for me, it was like, the insanity for me was the inability to see the truth, you know? I really just needed something other than myself to help me to see the truth. And in the beginning, that was the group. That was, you know, the people at Casa Serena. That was my sponsor. You know, that was the women in this program, you know? So I did a good step 1, 2, and 3. When it came to doing the fourth step, I can tell you that I feel I was tricked into doing my fourth step. My sponsor at the time told me that she was going to be starting school and that if I needed to get through it so that she could have time for me. And it was very hesitant, and I was like, I have to write this stuff down, and oh my gosh, but I did it. And I remember calling her as I was doing it, and I just started bawling, you know, and I'm like, whoa, you didn't tell me it was going to feel like this. And she was like, well, you know, I want you to think about it. I want you to think that you're driving in a car, and this made perfect sense to me. You're driving in a car, right? And for however many years you were drinking and using, you were taking stuff and you were eating, you were throwing the trash in the back seat. So you're eating your stuff and you're throwing the trash in the back. And you're eating your stuff and you're throwing the trash in the back. And you get sober is you hitting the brakes. And all that trash has now just come in and it's on you. You know, you got to get yourself out, and it's not comfortable, and it doesn't feel good, and sometimes it hurts, but it will get better. Just keep doing what you're doing. And I did for the first time in my life. I just took suggestion, and I did, and it did get better, and I shared with her, and I thought she was going to be like, ugh. And she didn't. She would share stories with me, and I was just like, oh, my gosh, and I finally have my first real relationship with somebody, you know. And then she wanted me to write down these character defects and do all these things. And I just started to see, I started to get to see who I was, you know. And I got to choose what to get discarded and what to keep with the help of you people in these rooms, you know. And that's just amazing. You know what I mean? Like, who gets to do that? It came to the whole amends thing. And you know, I can honestly say that I never stole from my family except for one time. And it was the hardest thing, the amends to make to my dad, because my dad was my best friend, and I had taken his original wedding ring that he had custom made with my mom, and I had taken it and hawked it for the gold. And it was Christmas, and they had come down the Casa to visit me, and I was so nervous. And I had written out my mom's amends and done hers, and I had called my grandma and made hers, and it was time to make this one to my dad, and I was just like, I don't know if I can do this. And, you know, it was weird. I didn't think I was going to do it that day. It really wasn't planned. And we were done at the little gathering at the house, at the main house, because now he's at the grad house. And we got in the car, and we stopped in front of the grad house, and, you know, something was just tugging on me. And I looked at my dad, and I said, Dad, I have something to tell you. And I just started weeping. And I told him what I did. And he looked at me and he said, well, good, now I can stop looking for it. And then he told me, you know, honey, I've never lost anything that's worth any value except for my son. And I'm glad that I didn't lose you. And then he got to look at me and say, and I want you to know, he apologized to me for turning me in and for some other stuff. And he said, and I just want you to know that doing what we did was harder than having to bury our own son. And there was like healing there with my family that I never thought was going to be, you know. And I was able to talk with my mom, and me and my mom didn't have the best relationship. You know, every time she looked at me, she saw my biological father. So we were always at odds, you know. There was always that tension. There was always that we were trying to be better than each other and one-up each other. And it was just a really sick, twisted relationship, you know. And it's not like that today. So I made those amends, you know, I started getting to look at my life on a daily basis, you know. And it's weird because things, if I did something wrong throughout the day or something that wasn't really okay, like, it just didn't sit well with me. Like, I grew a conscience. It's really weird. Like, something I never knew I had. I grew feelings. I grew a conscience. I started caring about you. I started caring about myself. Just bizarre. And I got that, you know, when we were wrong, we would promptly admit it. You know what I mean? Because I wouldn't sleep well. Like, I would try to ignore it, but I would have restless sleep. And I'd be there. See, I'm new in sobriety, so I don't understand these things. You know, my sponsor's like, well, this is kind of the deal. And, you know, I'm like, God, well, when is it just going to be okay, you know? It's a very slow process for me, you know. And then you want me to start praying and meditating? Oh, my gosh, I can't do that, you know. We would do meditation circles, and I would fall asleep. Like, yeah, you know, but I found little ways to meditate. Like, I would stand in the shower, and I would just let the water hit me, you know, and I would just thank God for another sober day. And I got to find a God that wasn't the God that was my God when I was a kid, you know. I got to find a God of my own understanding, and I got to find a loving God, and a non-judgmental God. And I really came into spirituality, and I started like branching out, you know, I come from a very religious family, you know, I went to private schools my whole life, and, you know, but I got to branch out. I started, like, looking into Buddhism and, like, doing this, and I just got to find my own thing, you know, and nobody judged me, and nobody cared, and it was just, like, my deal, you know, my relationship with my higher power, and it worked, you know, and I was able to share that with my mom, and there was no, she was like, whatever's working for you, you know, when before she was always damning and condemning, and you should be in church, and you should be doing this, and she's just like, I don't care what it is, whatever's working, sweetheart, I'm cool with it. I'm like, yeah, right. So she, like, when it came home, she, like, built me this meditation garden. It was really kind of nice, you know, and then you guys told me that I had to start giving back. You know, and I had to start freely giving what was freely given to me, and that's what I started doing. I was at Casa Serena for the full year. It wasn't an easy road for me, I'll say that. You know, one of the stipulations the judge had on me was no contact with my kids. And so, of course, when I first got into CASA, I put myself on calendar and was like, okay, I'm in a recovery program, like, you can give me my kids back now. And he was like, yeah, no, you know, and I was pissed, and I was like, whatever, you know, and gave him attitude again and left, and did the 90 days and went back to court, and he said, no, and it was like, I was changing. So I was like, so you want me to go to the grad house? Okay, you know. And I didn't end up actually getting my kids back, you guys, until I had, like, 9 months in the program. And then my last 90 days there, my kids got to come every weekend. And what a blessing in disguise, and how amazing, you know. My God is right on time, because I got a weekend with each one of my kids by themselves. And I got to have that healing process with my children, you know. And I got to go back to school, and I ended up graduating with my degree in criminology from the Santa Barbara City College. I ended up getting a job, which I never thought would happen. I applied at Sears, and they totally shot me down, and that was like, oh, I'm never going to be able to work, you know, and I was stressed because I was trying to pay my rent, and I would hear in these rooms, just keep doing what you're doing, God will make a way, keep putting one step in for the other, you're right where you need to be, and I would just be like, whatever, you guys, if you roll out my rap sheet, it's as long as this table, nobody's gonna hire me. And I was the smart alcoholic, right? And drug addict, like, I never got busted for drugs or alcohol. You know, I had to get busted for white collar crimes because I didn't want the courts to know that I had a problem, because I didn't have a problem, you know? So that did not work in my favor, you know what I mean? Working with money and trying to get a job with fraud and identity theft, and it's just not easy. But you guys were right, and I don't know how, but I applied at Aaron Brothers, and, you know, I was honest, because you guys told me to be honest, and I said I've been convicted of a felony, and, you know, I had a freaking box on my leg, you guys, like, it was very obvious that I was a felon, and I was hired as a part-time sales associate, and my year was coming up. I was graduating from college. My year was coming up to move out of there, and it was time to come back to Santa Maria, and I was scared to death. I was scared to death, because this is where I was like, oh my gosh, you know, the pits of hell, I'm going to die. Can I please stay in Santa Barbara? You know, we are hooked up to ourselves like U-Haul trucks. We take our asses everywhere we go, and it's not about what's around us, it's about us. And I learned that, you know, and I learned that in these rooms. And so I did what you guys told me to do. And I went, before I moved back home, I would come home on the weekends, and I started going to the Pyramid Group. Or I went to the 1600 Club. And I started staying in the center of the herd. And I started meeting people. And I started, you know, finding my niche here, finding my sobriety here, so that when I moved here, I would have a safety net. You guys were my safety net. You guys are my GPS system. You know that when you're driving down the road and you, like, swerve and the GPS says, please, please return to the highlighted route. Like, that is you guys for me. When I start going like this, I hear you guys, please return to the highlighted route, you know? So I had to find that GPS system here, and that's what I did. I found my GPS system here. And when I moved home, the transition wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, you know? I got a sponsor here. I still worked in Santa Barbara. And I got a promotion to the lead sales associate, and they gave me keys to the store, and they gave me keys to the safe, and they gave me keys to the register, and I thought it was a setup. I really did. But you know, I just kept putting one foot in front of the other, and I kept doing the next right thing, and you know, next thing I know, we're getting walkthroughs from the vice president of Aaron Brothers, and she absolutely fell in love with me and said, you need to make her full-time. We need to get her in the bridge program. We need to start training her for management. What? Okay, she's crazy. But that's what I did, you know. And so I started training for management. And, you know, and that's what I do today. I am actually in the bridge program. I'm sitting waiting to be promoted to the assistant manager. I had a little scary thing happen a few weeks ago. A store auditor came in, and when a store auditor comes in, they go through everything. They go through everybody's files. They go for, you know, and so the background check in my file was for a part-time associate, and it was for an entry-level background. And now that I'm in the position that I'm in, I run the background checks on people, so I know what's involved in running a higher background. You know what I mean? And so I'm, like, freaking out, okay? I'm like, oh, my God. So my boss comes out, and he says, because my boss kind of knows my niche. I got my anklet off January 1st of this year after having it on 18 months. So my boss, you know, is really cool. He knows that I'm in the program. And he comes out and he's pissed off, and I'm like, what? And he's like, she wants me to run another background. And I, like, turned stark white, and I started crying. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to lose my job. It's over. You know? And he's like, just wait a minute. Just breathe, and let's do this. Everything's going to work out the way it's supposed to work out. And I'm like, you know? And I went out, and I called my sponsor, and she told me the same thing. And they ran it. And I even took a picture of it on my phone that it came back supervisor approved. And it's funny because, you know, I couldn't believe it. And my husband goes, did you give him the right social security number, Joanna? I said, yes, I did. I took a picture of it. Look, it says supervisor, you know, my position. This is my social. It's like for real and like legit. So, like, what a blessing is that, you know what I mean? And that would have never happened before. And it was funny because my boss looked at me and he goes, well, it shows you how good of a job Michael does when they hire people. I'm like, shut up, you know. Don't take this from me. This is amazing. So with all that, life is good. You know, I'm back in the house with my kids. You know, life is not perfect. I don't think that I was ever on a pink cloud. I know you guys hear about, I know that I used to hear that in the meetings, that like these pink clouds. And I don't think I was ever on a pink cloud. I know that I experienced a serenity that I never had experienced before. I understand when they talk about being rocketed into the fourth dimension, you know. I listen to the old timers, you know, I listen to Be Right Where Your Feet Are. I actually drive with a newcomer chip at the bottom of my car, you know, at the pedals. Because I got to remain there, you know what I mean? Because if I don't, then I'm done, you know? And as soon as I think that I've got this, I'm done. And that's just what I try to keep really in the fore focus of my mind today. You know, there's days that I want to kill my kids. There's days that I want to kill my husband. There's days that I wish that I didn't have the responsibility of my children, you know? I have a 16-year-old, a 12-year-old, and an 11-year-old, and it's not easy. You know, and they're just getting to learn this new sober mom, so they don't care if it's been 2 years. Like, they're still trying to test the boundaries with me, you know, and I'm, you guys are teaching me how to not raise my children out of guilt and shame and how to be a sober mother. You guys are teaching me how to be a sober wife. This is the longest I've ever been faithful to anybody in my life, you know, and I'm not saying that it's easy, you know what I mean? The only reason I can honestly say that I stayed married to my husband is because my sponsor told me I couldn't divorce him in the first 2 years of my sobriety. Okay? And that's just being real. You know what I mean? So I'm not going to sit here and say that there aren't days where I'm like, ha-ha, I'm over the 2-year mark. I'm getting those divorce papers ready, you know? But I got to, like, I think today before I do something, you know? And I have to remember that the reality of it is you know, they're not alcoholics. and they don't have the issues or the problems or the defects or whatever. They have their own shit and I have my shit. And as long as I work on me and I can start accepting you for who you are, you know, and it kind of makes things a little bit easier, you know. I'm able to be completely present today. You know, my grandfather's sick and I'm able to be there for my mom. I'm able to be there for my kids and able to be there for my job. That's something that I never would have been able to be, you know. I don't know. It's amazing. I absolutely, absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you're new and those who identify, those who didn't identify, you know, if you don't identify being an alcoholic, I totally get that. You know what I mean? Because I totally did not. I did not want the title of an alcoholic. The last thing that I wanted to be. I came from a family of them, and my aunt actually died of alcoholism. You know, my second year was dedicated to her. And that was not going to be my story. But today I can tell you that I'm absolutely grateful that it is my story, because what that means for me and what that looks like is that I have a solution. You know, I have a 12 and 12. I have a book that has a total blueprint. If I don't know what to do, I can seek other people in these programs. I can seek that book. You know what I mean? If you're working with a sponsor and if they're giving you nonsense that's not out of the book, I don't know if it's that. You know, I go by what's in that book because that's what's worked for me. And, you know, I was asked, well, you know, they said, well, how do you do it? I don't know what's keeping me sober, you guys. I don't know if it's the meetings. I don't know if it's the commitments. I don't know if it's the praying. I don't know if it's the honesty. I don't know if it's working with it. Like, I don't know what it is. And because I don't know what it is, I'm just going to keep doing it all, you know. And I had to stop trying to figure out, because I don't know shit. You know, little Miss Nodal Joanna, I don't know a damn thing. I could have a 4.0 GPA and be the top scholar in my school, but that doesn't mean I know what's going on. You know, my head got me right in the wrong places, you know. And, you know, I stopped, and I say this a lot, you know, I stopped giving direction and I started taking suggestions. You know, and that's what works. It's that easy. You know, people say, oh, it's an easy part. It really is. You know, getting sober for me was the easy part. It's staying sober that's hard. And I don't mean staying sober as far as like not taking a drink. I mean staying mentally sober. Because if I don't keep doing what I'm doing, you guys, I get batshit crazy real quick. I've had to call my sponsor a few times, you know, and be like, you know what, I'm going to cut this bitch. I don't care. She doesn't know I'm on probation until 2022. I'm going to take a 45 and stick it in her mouth. You know, and my son was like, well, I think you need to write on that. And 9 times out of 10, when I'm thinking like that, or when there's something going on in my mind about that, then there's something about that person that's totally reflecting what the hell's going on with me. I have this issue with this woman at my job, the assistant manager that I'm waiting to take her position. But we have issues, and it's like, you know, she really made me do some writing, and she really made me look at some shit, and you know what, you guys, it has nothing to do with Amy, absolutely nothing to do with Amy. It has to do with me, the shit I went through with my sister. It's crazy how this program works, but what a blessing, and I get to look in the mirror, and you know what, I like what I see today. You know, I used to be the girl that wore the Gucci and, you know, drove the Jag and, like, had the makeup and was bougie because I was so sick and hated what I was inside. Today, you will see me walk around this town in flip-flops, no makeup, hair up, dirty teeth. I do not care because I like who I am today. You know what I mean? And that's just what it is about. That's what it's about for me today is you guys showed me to love who I am, and you guys taught me that the things that I did in my alcoholism and the things that I did in my addiction were not who I was. That was the disease. That did not make me who I was, and for so long I was identified by what I did. I was a convict. I was an inmate. I was a dope fiend. I was a drunk. I was a shitty mom, and I wasn't. You know what I mean? Today, I'm just Joanna, and I like Joanna today, and it's amazing, and I have amazing friends. Thank you guys again for showing up. And you guys, if you stick around long enough and put your hand out, these people will love on you until you can love yourself. And when you can start walking, if you need them to hold your hand because you trip, they will put out their hand. It's just amazing how this program works. So anyways, thank you for asking me again, Billy, and thank you guys all for being here tonight.
Please give me your hand for Tyler Joanna. Okay, Tyler, it's all yours. Thank you for letting me be a
servant.
Thanks, Tyler. All right, I'm doing our college secretary. And great talk.